Gregory Wrightstone is our guest this hour. He's a geologist with more than 35 years of studying the Earth's processes. He earned a bachelor's degree from Waynesburg University and a master's from West Virginia University, both in the field of geology. He's also presented the results of his research around the world, including India, Ireland, and China. Gregory's book was the result of a quest for the truth about climate change, a subject uncritically reported by the mainstream media, of an earth lurching toward climate apocalypse. Great book, by the way. I know, Rick, you've got it in front of you and you've been reading it. Contrary to the hyperbole of climate alarmist, Wrightstone's review of the science provides the historical context of the earth that shows clearly that rising temperatures and increasing carbon dioxide are benefiting both the planet and the human condition. Greg is also a strong proponent of the scientific process and believes that policy decisions should be driven by science, facts, and data, not just by a political agenda. And he joins us this morning. Greg, it's so nice to have you on. Good morning.
Oh, it's good to be on with you as a fellow recent Florida resident. So I'm glad to talk with you.
Where have you moved from, Greg?
And we moved. I didn't move. I escaped from from the Keystone State, Pennsylvania.
Well, welcome to Florida. This is heaven comparatively.
Yeah, and it's good to have a governor that I can be proud of. So, it's good news. And I just had breakfast with your Byron, the congressman from Naples area this morning, which is just dynamic. I forget his last name, it escapes me right now, but. Just a dynamic young congressman there. He's doing great things.
He is. We've got a lot of talent coming up in the conservative side of things, and it's wonderful to see their successes.
And of course, just before we get into climate change, of course, I'm calling you from Arlington, Virginia. So the big news here was political last night in the governor's race, which was interesting, to say the least.
Well, I stayed up to watch it, so I'm sure a lot of people did. That's going to portend some immense major changes in the way things are done for the next 6 months at least. I'm sitting here, Greg, with a book called Inconvenient Facts that you wrote, and I have to tell you that this is one of the most interesting, easily readable scientific books I have ever picked up. You have a way of making easily understood processes and facts that most of your fellow scientists want to remain in confusion.
And well, thank you so much. You're flattering me with your kind words, but and it's amazing. The book, it was published nearly 4 years ago, and it was just last week. It was a number one bestseller. I guess it was 2 weeks ago now, number one bestseller in three categories. Two months ago, Candace Owens on her show did a monologue on climate change, and she said, and held up my book, Inconvenient Facts, and she said, this book has changed everything I believe about climate change. And she said, I'm going to recommend everyone to buy this book, and every child in America needs to read this book. And so, of course, that drew, and then she invited me down to Nashville, where she interviewed me for 22 minutes. She's gracious young Black conservative, that she's the voice of the rising conservative voices, and we're helping to educate her and others like Charlie Kirk and others at Turning Point USA on the truth and the facts about climate change. And in fact, we'll be traveling to Phoenix here in December to attend the big annual Turning Point USA convention.
That'll be great.
Oh, fantastic. Great lineup of speakers.
Well, all thinking, caring human beings want to preserve our environment to the very best of our ability. But we're being told that the cost of fixing our sins is more money than we have, and more money than we will have. This in itself causes intelligent people to ask for more than mere words. We want to know the facts. The problem is finding the facts. There is such a morass of fog out there. There's a lot of stories, but we need proof. So is that too much to ask?
No. No, there's a huge amount of misinformation being spread. They're trying to stoke a climate of fear. By them, I mean the UN, Al Gore, John Kerry, Joe Biden, AOC, the list goes on and on. And you have to wonder, some of these people actually believe it because it's all they've ever heard. But when we talk about this, I present the rational, sane, scientific facts that rebut so much that we hear in the media every day, because we hear about, climate change is causing fires, floods, catastrophic rise of sea level, islands are being inundated and people are having to move, islands are being swamped by rising seas driven by climate change. It's just one thing after a condo collapse in Miami was caused by climate change. And when we look at actually the science, the facts, and the data, show something exactly opposite. And we can go through some of these things just to talk about. For example, let's start with sea level rise. We're being told that Pacific Island and Indian Island nations around the Earth are in grave risk of being inundated. Entire towns will have to be moved because of climate change and rising sea levels. But the fact of the matter is, sea level has risen 8 inches since 1900. That's not very alarming to me, and that's a fact. Now, we do have some areas where, for example, Miami, parts of Miami are subsiding almost as fast as sea level is rising. So, of course, you get accelerated relative sea level in areas like that. But the fact of the matter is, too, recent studies show that many of these island nations in the Pacific are actually growing. It's a natural geologic process for these Pacific coral islands to grow. And we know that's a fact because if we look back over the last 15,000 years, we see that sea level, and are you ready for this? It's risen more than 400 feet over the last 15,000 years. But yet, here are these islands that grew along with 400 feet of sea level rise. And so I think these islands, after having grown, the geologic term is accretion with these islands that are growing. So they've grown along with sea level. They're still there. Another possible 8 inches of sea level rise, or 6 inches by the end of the century, is anything that's unusual. And those island nations will still be there. In fact, there was just an article today about the Maldives, one of the most supposedly at-risk island chains, and how it was in mortal danger. But if you Google Maldives and hotels, you'll find that the Maldives, there are 17 seaside hotel and resort complexes being constructed. Well, they're being funded by equity companies. They're being insured by insurance companies. These companies, particularly insurance companies, avoid risk like the plague. Do you think they would be investing these many, many millions of dollars in a seaside resort in the Maldives if they had any notion at all that they'd be putting their money and their investment at risk? They're voting with their pocketbooks, and they're saying, yeah, it's not going to happen. And so we see this. We also see, for example, much of the East Coast is subsiding slowly. Much of these, it's only 2 or 3 inches over a century or more. So it's not a big concern. So that's just one thing, is this sea level rise. We also see, they talk about fires in the West, in California, Oregon. And as part of the CO2 Coalition, we have some true fire experts that have studied this extensively, and are experts in that, that we can consult. And what we find is that actually the number and area burnt, you know, number of fires and area burnt have actually significantly declined over the last 80 or 90 years. The fires today in the Western United States are about 20% of what they were in the 20s and 30s. And it's, again, completely contrary to what we're being told. Now, some of the big fires are bigger and more intense. They are. That's a fact. But the entire area burned for the United States and the number of fires, again, is about 20% of what they were. But these, some of these fires have raged out of control. And that's a result of bad forest management practices. According to the Sierra Nevada Conservancy, there are 4 to 5 times too many trees per acre than what a healthy forest should have. And of course, your listeners are easy to understand that more trees means more fuel and a more intense fire. But also think about this, that if there are more trees per acre, the second greatest cause of soil moisture loss, the first is, of course, evaporation. The second greatest cause of soil moisture loss is all the moisture and water being drained out of the soil by the vegetation and trees. So now if you've got 4 to 5 too many trees, well, that's each tree is then competing for that same scarce soil moisture. So now you've got more fuel for the fire, and it's accelerating arid conditions by having too many trees per acre.
Mm-hmm. We just had this wonderful show out in Scotland, the COP26 summit in Glasgow, and they had a young lady named Brianna Fruian, who's from Samoa, and she's a student. She's not a scientist, not a politician, and she reminds me a bit of Greta Thunberg from Sweden. Mm-hmm. And that she's a student, and she doesn't even study science in school. And she's complaining that her home island, Tuvalu, will disappear, followed by Samoa. And she says, once those Pacific islands go, the world will go. Well, I don't think so, but
once again,
when that stuff makes the news.
Well, we can refute that with science, facts, and data. Tuvalu, those island nations have been most of those Pacific island nations have been growing, not shrinking. And Tuvalu and those others have grown about 2.5% in size over the last several decades. Again, they're marketing fear of imaginary apocalyptic events. And it's, they've been very effective doing it, and they don't get any pushback. They don't get no one to question them.
Well, I've got a quote for you that you can carry with you from H.L. Mencken. He says the whole aim of practical politics is to keep the population alarmed, and hence clamorous to be led to safety, by menacing it with an endless series of hobgoblins, all of them imaginary.
Yep.
He said that 100 years ago.
And actually, that's the quote I opened my first chapter of my book with.
Is it?
Hobgoblins of Alarm. Absolutely.
Oh, man. Well.
So, yeah, I love it. It's a great quote.
Yeah, it is. What about storms? Are they getting worse or not?
Well, we have to separate them. Well, let's talk, the easy one to debunk is tornadoes. Now, bear in mind, the United States is the world's leader of tornadoes. We have some, probably around 90% of all tornadoes on Earth occur here in the United States, just because of our geography and the weather patterns of our systems. And tornadoes in the United States have declined significantly and still are. The big ones, the F3s and above.
Are you talking about numbers of them or?
Numbers.
Yep. Okay.
And when we talk about intensity, they go by the Fujita scale, and F3s are the most destructive. And so if we take a chart of the F3 tornadoes, they're definitely in decline. And we look at the F3s because we can go back in time longer. A lot of tornadoes, again, tornadoes are like hurricanes. It's hard to do long-term data because these storms can rise up and disappear. No one back in the 1800s and early 1900s, the population wasn't as large, and maybe no one reported the tornado. But the really big tornadoes, according to NOAA, it was more likely that they would be recognized if it touched down. And so we look at that, and we can see with, if anything, they would be undercounted in the old data. So if anything, the decline in F3 and above tornadoes is significant and indisputable. And we go to, when we talk about hurricanes, even the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which I was accepted as an expert reviewer for that, they say there is no any linkage between climate and both the number and intensity of hurricanes. And in fact, another big metric we know for sure are landfalling hurricanes in the United States. To go back to 1850, that number of landfalling hurricanes has been declining. And that's a good metric to use. Just hurricanes themselves, you can't go back very far. Because in the satellite era, we don't miss any tornadoes, hurricanes. Back in the 1900s and 1800s, again, according to NOAA, if a hurricane made landfall in the United States, they would know about it. Somebody would report it. We'd know about it. It's hard to miss a hurricane making landfall. But a lot of these hurricanes now, I mean, we know they initiate and they stay out to sea, and maybe no one knows about them. But again, landfalling hurricanes in the United States are in decline. Extreme weather deaths, we're being told that more people are dying from extreme weather. Nothing is further than the truth. If we look at severe weather related deaths, they've been, get this, more than a 98% decline over the last 100 years. Now, granted, a lot of that has to do with prediction. Get away from the coast, there's a hurricane coming. We're expecting a tornado, severe tornado possibility. Get in your basement, and the horns. You know, they in the 1920s and 30s, they didn't have that. So part of this is our technology and predictive capabilities.
Well, we talk about weather fatalities. There's more to weather fatalities and storms. I live in Florida, and I'm not afraid of warmer weather. In fact, I think a lot of my northern relatives would wish that it would get a little bit warmer. But isn't there more deaths from cold weather than there are from warm?
Oh, absolutely. And it's significant. In my book, I capture the largest study of its time. It was a lead author was Antonio Gasparini. He looked at 74 million weather-related deaths, temperature-related deaths, I should say. He found, and this looked at, I think, 14 different countries, both warm and cold. He found there were 20 times as many people that die of cold and cold-related deaths as they do from heat. So from that, you could conclude that global warming would save lives. Of course, when you say that, heads are spinning. You know, they don't want to hear that. It goes against the narrative of human caused global warming causing increased deaths. And it's just completely false. Just wrong, wrong, wrong. There's another study from England and Wales that showed, in that case, they concluded there were 15 times as many. Was it 15 or 20, whatever it is, a lot more people die from cold than they do from heat.
Indeed. Well, is it warmer today than the Earth has ever been? I mean, if you remember your school studies, the Earth was a molten ball of stone and metal for eons, and well, it's been cooling ever since.
Our temperatures today are some of the coldest they've been on Earth's history, dating back to the Precambrian. Most of Earth was about 10 degrees Celsius, which is a little bit less than 15 degrees Fahrenheit warmer during most of Earth's history. And so when we look at this, we're in this period of ice ages now. We happen to be in a, thank God, we're in a blessedly warm, it's called an interglacial cycle that we're in the pre-sea that is taking place. We've been in this for about 11,000 years now. These interglacial periods last anywhere from 10 to 12, some of them 15,000 years in length, and we're nearing the end. So at some point, we're going to get back into that glacial advanced stage. And when that's happening, back whenever Donald Trump was president, I was used to joke that he was building the wall on the wrong border, because when the next ice age comes, you're going to have every single Canadian heading south, because virtually all of Canada was completely under hundreds and thousands of feet of ice during the last ice advance.
Well, when that happens, I expect Al Gore is going to be talking about a different kind of climate change, and he'll be trying to scare people with cold weather instead of warm.
Yeah, well, that's what we should be preparing for. No one's thinking about it. What do we do when it does turn cold? It's going to come. I don't think it'll be for a while. It may be, but it could be we're entering the next cold phase right now, and we don't know it. Those things we can't figure out. It's hard to predict. Your H.L. Mencken quote was good. I've got one that I really like from Yogi Berra. He said, making predictions is really tough, especially about the future. So, you know, you got to love Yogi Berra quotes, but I think we're probably pretty good that we'll be in this warming trend for another, at least many decades, maybe 100 years or 150 years. But sooner or later, it's going to get cold, because we know, looking through Earth's history over the last 10,000 years, that's what we've seen, just cycles of warming and cooling.
We tend to look at the environment in much too small of a time frame, those of us who are not scientists. I mean, you cannot look at a 10-year span and really hope to gather much intelligence from it.
Well, it's not just 10 years, but typically the climate alarmists will look back 100 or 150 years, and that's where they come up with this. It's the hottest year or month or whatever it is ever recorded. Well, if your recording only goes back to 1850, that would be true. But if we take it back, these cycles are 1,000+ years apart. The last warming trend we were in was called the medieval warm period. It occurred from the years 850 to about 1250, so it was about 1,000 years ago. During that time, it was much warmer than it is today. And we know that from historical records. The great, great records were kept of wine growing regions being much farther north today, and they could grow olives farther north than they can be grown today. We know that the Vikings were growing barley on Greenland during the medieval warm period. You can't grow barley there today. The growing seasons aren't long enough to grow barley. They can grow wheat, which is cold tolerant, and it's been modified to be cold tolerant, and they can get the harvest in during a short growing season.
I've got a break here. We have to pay the bills, which means we've come to the halfway point of our show, and we need to do some commercials. So we will take a break for a moment and be right back. And I don't know where my Carrie is gone, but she'll edit this out.
Okay.
This is great fun. I have been trying so hard to get someone like you on the show. I had an interview with Patrick Moore, but his health prevented that from happening. We've been unable to reschedule it, but you know, the number of scientists who are starting to come out from under the shadows and address the facts as they exist seems to be increasing.
Yeah, well, I just got an email from Patrick. So, I mean, I'm in contact with him nearly every day. He hired me here at the CO2 Coalition back in October of last year. We stay in contact.
Fabulous. Well, I'd love to get him on. We had that scheduled and then something happened and we'll have to reschedule.
Hello.
But, you know, I see Michael Schellenberger has been changing his positions and various other scientists. I'm actually sending a copy of your book to my nephew, who's a physician, and he is a believer in the dangers of climate change, and it's you know, he doesn't want to talk to anybody because he spends a lot of time studying the facts. Well, I think he's studying the wrong facts, so I'll send him your book. I have a topic that we have to cover, and that's CO2, Greg. That is the cornerstone of all these people talking about climate change.
Oh, it is. They're painting it as the demon molecule when the reality is carbon dioxide, it should be considered the miracle molecule. It's benefiting the earth tremendously. The earth is what they call greening, and vegetation, again, we talked earlier, has been thriving, and NASA recognizes this. It's not NASA, NOAA. All the scientific groups that look at this are all in agreement that the earth is benefiting greatly from increasing CO2. According to NASA, up at least 50%, up to 50% of the Earth's surface is greening, or other, in other words, vegetation's increasing. Only 4% of the Earth's surface is what they call browning, or loss of vegetation. And again, what this does, it's providing crops and food for people to use. And what this does, the modest warming means that growing seasons are lengthened. Killing frosts end earlier in the spring and arrive later in the fall. That means we've got longer growing seasons. You get more plantings in, grow more crops, and then that's turbocharged by the CO2 fertilization effect. And of course, in photosynthesis, it's the process of sunlight and the plants breathing in, if you will. It's called transpiration. They breathe in the carbon dioxide, convert it into glucose and oxygen, and then they expel, or if you would, exhale, if you will, oxygen. And then that's the process. And by with higher CO2 levels, then your plants grow bigger, faster, more crops are developed, more food is developed. And that's why we see people, if you're growing marijuana in your greenhouse, which I don't think you are, but if you were, you would probably be pumping CO2 into it. We're in the process of our latest paper will be on nutrition and CO2 and the relationship between increasing CO2 and nutrition. It's fascinating. And in fact, I was just in Pennsylvania back in August during corn harvest, you know, whenever the sweet corn's coming in, and I've got a CO2 monitor, and I, outside along the road, it was at a little over 400 parts per million, and I walked into the field and it dropped almost 300 parts per million. And why is that? And because there wasn't much wind blowing. And what, why is that? Because the corn's just sucking that CO2. You're in amongst the corn and it's low CO2 levels. And I had never, you don't think about it like that. And the Professor Galligan, Dr. Galligan, explained that would the best thing for crop growth and corn, well, particularly corn growth, is a light breeze that mixes up the CO2, the low CO2 in the cornfield with the higher CO2 out of it. And I'd never heard about that before, and it makes sense. So, and that's why they also have in greenhouses, they have fans going, again, to mix up that higher CO2 air with the low CO2 around the plants. And again, it accelerates the levels. And they typically like to get the CO2 levels in greenhouses up to about 1,000 parts per million. And again, our ambient carbon dioxide levels right now are a little over 400 parts per million.
Well, again, you know, that's an interesting point. I'd like to talk for a second about the numbers themselves. We all know that at 150 parts per million, CO2 starvation happens and plants die.
Yes.
So there's a point at which CO2 cannot fall below or we're all dead. But I keep asking climatologists, and I use that term loosely, what is the optimal CO2 concentration? And nobody will give me an answer. Nobody says we need to be at 300 or 400 or 800. They won't venture a number. Why is that?
And I can't either. I can tell you that whatever that number is, it's probably well above 1,000 parts per million or 2.5 times what we are today. No one's anticipating that to occur for the next hundreds of years at this rate of CO2 increase. And so there's no danger to this. And in fact, OSHA requirements in terms of workplace CO2, it really doesn't start kicking in with dangers until you get approaching 10,000 parts per million. And in fact, submarines often have levels well over 8,000 parts per million. And the U.S. Navy doesn't consider that dangerous. So,
kindergarten classes will reach 2,000 after an hour's class.
Yeah. And I see it at conferences when you're a lot of people, you often get over 1,000 parts per million. And if we look at it in the long-term perspective, the geologic perspective, we're actually CO2 impoverished. Again, we're a little over 400 parts per million now. Throughout Earth's history, dating back to the Precambrian, 600 plus million years ago, the average level of CO2 on Earth was about 2,600 parts per million. And then about 140 million years ago, we started into a serious, significant, and dangerous decline of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And why was it dangerous? Because it was declining, and it nearly reached that, what I call the line of death. Well, you referenced that 150 parts per million at the end of the last ice age. That's thought to be the lowest carbon dioxide level in Earth's history, dating back to the Precambrian. And so we almost crossed that line of death. And once we cross 150 parts per million and plant life can't survive, well, that would be a true climate apocalypse. So what we're doing is seeing, it's just opposite of what we're being told. How many times have you heard me say that today?
Yeah.
And it's just opposite, that we're actually CO2 impoverished, looking at all of Earth's history.
Well, on a funny note, I actually heard a commentator on CNN last night suggest that climate change was the reason that McAuliffe lost the election in Virginia.
Yeah, I can't follow that. Well, last week Kamala Harris said that the reason the immigration problem was caused by climate change, that these people were fleeing their nations because of, well, no, I heard that, and I went and looked at the data of crop growth, Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador. Well, they're breaking records year after year. Last year, they set a record for many of the harvests for their crops, and they expect to do the same, break another record this year. So no, it's not climate change. Climate change is accelerating crop growth in those Central American countries. They're fleeing. They're coming here for, I can't blame them. I mean, it's the land of opportunity, but you know, it's not climate change that's driving them here.
Well, we absolutely need to have more CO2 because our population is growing so fast that feeding the population will require a lot more plants.
And so, we're providing it. I just hired a gentleman out of Bengaluru, India, Vijay Jayaraj, who's a gifted writer and a scientist. And he talks about, among other things, energy poverty, but he also talks about crop growth in India. India is one of the hottest nations on earth. And they're breaking records year after year for all sorts of crops in India. And it's a great thing. It's fantastic what's going on. And again, we're seeing this across sub-Saharan Africa as well, India, China, dry parts of Australia and China are greening. For example, the Southern Sahara, it's an area known as the Sahel, 200,000 square kilometers of the Sahel. It's found in the Sudan and Chad. They're turning into lush grasslands where people are moving back in, where they haven't lived there for more than 1,000 years, and they're planting crops. And it's, again, we're being told deserts are expanding. No, they're not. No, they're not. Deserts are shrinking. And once again, I'm going to say it again, it's just opposite of what we're being told.
Well, everything is opposite. I mean, they tell us that the ice in the Antarctic is shrinking, but if you look at the NASA satellite data and their measurement of ice mass, you'll find the story is totally different, that the Antarctic ice mass is growing, not shrinking.
It is. And as a geologist, I find this fascinating. The fact of the matter is there is a slight increase in overall ice in Antarctica. Now, there are two places in Antarctica that have a decrease in ice. It's the Antarctic Peninsula and Western Antarctica. And that's because it's really interesting, the warming isn't coming from the atmosphere. The warming is coming underneath the ice. It's a geologic hotspot. It's called the West Antarctica Rift Zone. It's the largest accumulation of volcanic area in the world. It's called Nature's Blowtorch, and it's under the ice. But no one talks about that. They talk about this Thwaites Glacier or the Glacier of Doom, and they always refer to this. Well, the reason the Thwaites Glacier is shrinking is because of this volcanic activity. It has nothing to do with climate change.
Nothing to do with climate change. Well, you can't get money if you don't scare people, huh?
Well, that's a good way to get them. Yeah, fear is a great motivator. They use it very effectively. And again, they need to silence people like me and the scientists of the CO2 Coalition. In fact, if your listeners want to learn more about this information that I'm presenting, they can go to the co2coalition.org. co2coalition.org. I've got a great section. I've got a climate quiz they can take. We have a section on climate facts. A lot of the information, easily readable charts, are at that site. Just look for climate facts, and I've got it. We've got it so it's easily downloadable. So you can download these images for your own use. And we encourage people to do that. That's our goal. Our mission is to provide these inconvenient facts to the population. I want to thank you, for doing your part in this. And we need to get this information out there. And they want to stifle people like me. For example, I was just removed from the social media platform LinkedIn a month or so ago. And it all went back in August. They started deleting. I had a huge following on LinkedIn, and I posted scientific, factual information. And, I would post things and I get 30, 40,000 views pretty quickly, regularly. And they started removing as soon as I would put them up. And the very last post that I made on LinkedIn, it said, "I think I'm about to be banned and deplatformed from LinkedIn." Well, they removed it called it false and misleading, and then they banned and deplatformed me. Can you believe it? You don't know whether to laugh or cry. You don't know whether to laugh or cry. Well, then I went, I said, well, you know, I had such a great following. I appealed it. And in my appeal, I was very short. I said, I will post only factually correct information. And they said, nope, we don't allow that kind of information on LinkedIn. And that, so you can't make this stuff up.
Well, I've been banned from more social media than he can shake a stick at. I don't even care. You know,
yeah.
There will be better ways to get to people. So talk to me about the poor polar bears.
Well, we don't hear much about them anymore. 10-15 years ago, they were the iconic image of global warming. You'd see a polar bear that was stranded on a small ice floe.
I remember that.
Oh, yeah. Or the most recently, there was a starving polar bear just barely crawling by. Well, yeah, bears die. I mean, they have a lifespan of 20 some years, but not much more than that. So we've probably got 30 plus thousand bears. So that means about 1500 bears die each year from old age and starvation, not from climate change. So, I mean, bears don't live forever, and they found one that was dying and they made a huge hoorah about it. But no, polar bear populations have been increasing for about 30, 40, 50 years. But a lot of it goes back to in the late 70s, there was a ban on polar bear hunting, trophy hunting with polar bears. And that was a good thing they stopped that. But right now, there's so many polar bears that the Inuits up there are clamoring for more, being able to harvest more polar bears. To cut the danger down, because apparently humans taste a lot like seal, because we're on the polar bear menu. Who knew?
Well, that's a scary thought, but you know, at least they don't come down to Florida. I'd hate to see a polar bear against an alligator.
Oh yeah, and I'm not sure who would win that one. I think the polar bear would. They're pretty ferocious.
Yeah, bears are unbeatable. You know, but Greg, but don't 97% of scientists agree that we're ruining our ecology?
Well, 90s, that's a contrived statement. That's based on a study by John Cook and his merry band of climate extremists.
At the University of Queensland, because I lived there.
Okay, well then, yeah, what he did, he cast a very wide net to get to that number, and I would be included in that 97% that we always hear about, because I believe that CO2 is increasing. I believe that CO2 is a greenhouse gas, and the increase of CO2 has to have some warming effect on the atmosphere. It just does. I just don't think it's very, very great. I think it's greatly overwhelmed by the same forces that have been driving temperatures up and down since the dawn of time. So he would include me in that 97% consensus. So again, he cast a wide net to get to that. And all the 70 plus scientists here at the CO2 Coalition would agree with me on that. And they would all be part of that so-called consensus. I call it a nonsensus.
Well, you know, if science was that easy, everybody'd be doing it.
Yeah.
They just get together, nod, and agree, and that would be that.
Yeah, and science is not consensus, and consensus is not science. It's not how it works. The greatest loss of all this is the loss of the scientific process of debate. And they don't want any science or any scientists that can talk rationally and present facts and science that disputes this idea of man-made catastrophic warming. So I would tell your listeners, sleep well. There is no climate crisis. Sleep well. There is no climate emergency. Life is good. Ecosystems are thriving and prospering, and the human condition is improving. And we should celebrate that.
Oh, I'm ready to party, believe me. And there's a lot like me, too. The average American, when asked, said he would not spend more than $10 a month to save the environment. And that tells us that the case is yet to be made for the average American that the alarmists are right. We just don't believe it. And that's a good thing. We're smarter than they think we are.
Yeah, I'm a big optimist. I talk to a lot of people, obviously, about climate change, and just random people, just about everybody I talk to is skeptical of this notion of man-made catastrophic warming. They're thirsty for this information that I can provide and that we provide at the CO2 Coalition and in the book Inconvenient Facts. So they want to know this information because it's been hidden from them, and it'll continue to be hidden from them.
Well, tell us about the app, because I have it on my phone and I love it, but tell the listeners what it does and how they can get it.
Yeah, if you've got an Android or an iPhone, you can go to either the App Store or Google Play and just search for Inconvenient Facts. It gives you all this information, easily understandable charts, and it links to a small amount of text to describe. It also links to the source. Each one of these charts is sourced and referenced because that's important to know where the data is coming from. Too often we see just charts out there on Facebook or all these social media that aren't, anybody can make up a chart. It's important to source and reference it, which I've done. I've linked to some videos that I've created. And we're going forward here at the CO2 Coalition. We'll be replicating that and making it better over the next 6 months or so.
Good. Well, it's marvelous for when you're talking to people to be able to pull out your phone and show them real, true facts, which they won't believe unless they want to. But at least you're armed with it. And you know how to present it in a way that's logical. But, you know, science is really fallen down over the last 50 or so years. Not only, you know, geology and climatology and all of those things, but our medical science seems to be pushing stories on us that we know are not true. Why is it that so many scientists are willing to be quiet and pretend that nothing is happening when somebody's running away with the story?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I'm asked that a lot. Basically, what you're asking is, why are they lying to us?
Yeah.
And I can't see inside men's and women's souls to see their motivation. I think it's different for various people. Some people are just are true believers that, and plus, if you're a scientist and you've published on this, it's really hard to go back and reevaluate and say, you know what, I've made a mistake. And it's hard for someone to stand up to this vast number of people that they'll be ostracized. Their funding will be cut off.
Well, there you go. That's a key motivator, grants.
Absolutely.
If you don't promote the scare tactic du jour, you won't be funded for your next year's work.
Yeah, and that's right. And you'll be ostracized. And everybody wants to be respected by their peer group. And if you stand up and do that, you'll be thrown out of the cool kids club. You won't be invited to the right conferences. You'll be excluded. You'll lose your funding. And we've seen time and time again, unless you're tenured or retired, you better just shut up and go along. March in lockstep with the global this global idea of man-made catastrophic warming. It's a lot easier to do than standing up. It takes a courageous person to stand up and say this and risk everything. And it turns out there aren't very many courageous people.
Well, yep. I am so delighted that we have you, because you're one of them, and Patrick Moore is another. And they seem to be standing up in greater numbers these days. And hooray for you.
No, well, thank you. And you know, thank you for having me on and you know, getting some of this information out there. I very much appreciate it. And
great. All right.